He was the shadow behind the window, the breath in the dark. For decades, he raped, murdered, and vanished, leaving nothing but silence and broken lives across California. They called him the Golden State Killer. But he wasn't a ghost. He was a cop, a neighbor, a father. This is the true story of how we hunted a monster for 40 years and finally unmasked the man who thought he'd never be caught. From DNA breakthroughs to courtroom reckonings, this isn't just a story of justice. It's a reckoning told by someone who lived in his shadow. I know, because that fear never left my bones. Welcome to the Murder Tape Chronicles audiobook. If you haven't already, please consider following us on your favorite podcast platform. Today we present to you Golden State Killer. Let's dive into this thrilling narrative together. Chapter 1. The Shadow That Followed Us Home. The first time I remember fear settling into my bones, I was 10 years old. A warm, windless night in the summer of 1977, Sacramento. The kind of night where the air itself felt thick and unmoving, like it knew something was coming, but didn't want to speak. Crickets buzzed like they always did, distant dogs barked at nothing, and the moonlight spilled in through my bedroom window like spilled milk across the floor. Then it happened. Not a crash. Not a scream. Just a click. A soft, almost hesitant click, like a window latch being gently turned by someone who didn't belong there. I sat up in bed, eyes wide, breath caught in my chest, listening. Silence. But the kind of silence that vibrates. The kind that feels like something is watching you from the dark corners of the room. I didn't sleep that night. I don't think I slept much for the rest of that year. Three houses down, a woman was raped. We didn't know the details at first, just the flashing red and blue lights, the hurried voices of police officers moving through the dark, and the whisper-quiet conversation of adults trying to shield their kids from horror. But kids always know. We can smell fear, even if we don't have the words for it. Later, my mom told me in a cracked voice that the man had come in through the back sliding door. That he tied the woman up while her husband was forced to lie on his stomach, terrified and helpless. That he raped her, repeatedly, and then disappeared into the night like a shadow that didn't belong to anyone. Gone. Just like that. They called him the East Area Rapist. At first, we thought it was a fluke. A tragedy. An isolated monster slithering through an open door. But it wasn't. He struck again. Then again. And again. Always the same pattern. Middle-class neighborhoods. Well-kept homes. Late at night. Couples. He'd sneak in with surgical precision, turn the place into a hellscape, and vanish without a trace. No fingerprints. No DNA. Just eerie trophies sometimes missing. A wedding ring. A pair of panties. A photo of the family. Nothing valuable. Just intimate, disturbing reminders that he had been there. That he had the power. People lost their fucking minds. My neighborhood transformed overnight. Curtains stayed drawn. Dogs were suddenly welcome inside. Men slept with guns tucked beneath their pillows, and mothers barely slept at all. The hardware store ran out of locks, bolts, motion detectors. I remember my dad and two other men from the block taking turns doing unofficial neighborhood patrols at night with flashlights and baseball bats. No one knew who this guy was, but every single one of us felt like his next victim. The media didn't help. Headlines screamed, "Serial rapist terrorizes suburbs." Sketches of a masked man flooded TV screens. Tips poured in by the hundreds. And yet nothing. Not a single lead that ever stuck. It was like chasing a ghost. A ghost that didn't just kill or rape, but planned meticulously, chillingly. He studied his victims. He watched them. He called them, sometimes weeks in advance, whispering threats. "I'm going to kill you." Click. Dial tone. He once called a woman over 100 times after the attack. My obsession started young. I began collecting newspaper clippings. I kept them hidden under my mattress in a folder marked private. I'd lay on the floor and trace the lines of the neighborhood map with a pen, connecting the crime scenes, trying to find logic in the madness. I thought stupidly that maybe I could help solve it, that if I paid close enough attention, I might catch something everyone else missed. But he stopped. Just like that, the attack ceased, and silence settled back over California like fog that had finally cleared. People went back to work. They reopened windows. They breathed again. Time passed. I grew up, got married, became a journalist, had 2 daughters of my own. My own life started to crack in different ways, an affair, a separation, nights where I drank too much to numb the ache of everything unraveling. I left Sacramento, thinking I'd buried that chapter of my life somewhere under the dust of old trauma and growing pains. Then, 2018, I remember the morning like a thunderclap. I was sipping bitter hotel coffee in a shitty motel off Route 99, halfway through a freelance assignment I didn't give a damn about, when my phone lit up with a push notification that stopped me cold. Golden State killer identified after decades, former police officer arrested. My hands went numb. He had a name. A fucking name. Joseph James D'Angelo. 72 years old. A father. A retiree. A fucking cop. A man who once served as the very thing we prayed would save us. And all along, he had been the devil behind the mask. I collapsed onto the edge of the bed, eyes scanning every word of that article. DNA. Genetic genealogy. Old crime scene samples matched to relatives who had used family tree services online. They built a family map, followed the leaves on the branches, zeroed in, arrested him in his driveway. Just like that. 40 fucking years. And they got him. I stared out the window for a long time, watching the world move around me like it didn't just change forever, like history hadn't been rewritten in real time. That night, I didn't sleep. Just like when I was 10, I lay in bed, haunted by old memories and new rage. And more than anything else, I felt this pull. Not curiosity. Not justice. Something deeper. Need. Because suddenly I knew, I wasn't done with him. He haunted my childhood. Now, I would haunt his legacy. I would walk through the wreckage he left behind. Every crime scene. Every interview. Every victim. Every secret. Because this story, it wasn't over. Not for me. And not for the world that deserved to feel what we had lived through in silence. The man we feared in whispers for decades had finally been unmasked. But the scars, the questions, the horror, they were still very much alive. And I was about to drag them back into the light. Chapter 2, Beneath the Mask. I flew back to Sacramento the next morning. Didn't call my editor. Didn't cancel the other assignment. I just packed a duffel, turned off my phone, and drove straight to the airport like something inside me had snapped. Not in a reckless way, more like a pressure valve finally giving out after 4 decades of slow, invisible tension. It wasn't just a story anymore. It was personal. It had always been personal. I landed, rented a car, and went straight to the place where everything began, my childhood home. It was still there. A modest one-story, blue-trimmed house on a cul-de-sac that looked smaller than I remembered. The street was quiet now, peaceful. A couple of kids rode bikes past me without a care in the world. They had no idea what once hunted these sidewalks at night. I just sat there for a long time in the rental car, watching the house like a scene from a memory I couldn't stop replaying. That click I heard as a boy, was it real? Or just my mind trying to shape fear into something tangible? Maybe it didn't matter. What mattered was what happened after. The woman 3 doors down, her name was Diane. I found that out later, through court documents and crime logs buried deep in dusty boxes at the city records office. Her testimony had been redacted in early news reports, scrubbed from public view. But I found it. I read it. And God help me, I'll never forget it. She said he wore a ski mask, all black, with only his eyes showing. Cold. Calculated. No hesitation. He didn't yell. He whispered, "Don't move. Don't make a sound, or I'll kill your husband." He tied them up using shoelaces, sometimes taken directly from the victim's own sneakers. He used towels, pillowcases, anything he could find to blindfold them. He would place plates on the backs of the men and say, "If I hear these rattle, I'll kill her." And then he'd drag the woman into another room, sometimes for hours. They'd listen to the muffled sounds, sometimes crying, sometimes silence. Always horror. Then he'd vanish, slipping into the dark like fog retreating at dawn. I felt like I'd stepped into a time capsule of terror. Every record I pulled led me deeper into the labyrinth of what this man did. This wasn't random. This was ritual. He didn't just invade homes, he invaded lives. Left fingerprints on people's souls. And yet, no one could catch him. Until 2018. The first time I saw his face was during the press conference. His mugshot. Gray-haired. Liver spots on his cheeks. Faded blue eyes half-lidded, like he didn't give a damn. He looked like someone's grandpa. Like the guy who might sit on a porch in a rocking chair and wave to passing cars. But behind that face lived a predator. I remember staring at the screen in disbelief. That's him? That's the monster? It didn't make sense. The mind wants monsters to look like monsters. Sharp teeth. wild eyes, blood under the fingernails. Not this wrinkled, washed-out sack of rot. But evil doesn't always announce itself. Sometimes it hides in plain sight. Sometimes it wears a uniform. That's what got to me the most. Joseph D'Angelo was a former cop. He had patrolled the very streets he would later terrorize. He knew response times, knew protocols, knew how to clean a scene, knew how to manipulate fear like a puppet on a goddamn string. And when he was fired in 1979 for shoplifting dog repellent and a hammer, two items that suddenly meant something far darker, his crimes escalated from rape to murder. I wanted to scream, to punch a wall, to dig him up from the courtroom holding cell and make him talk. Why? Why them? Why us? Why hide in the shadows and steal lives from the inside out? I wasn't alone in asking. At the courthouse, I met one of the survivors. Her name was Kristen, late 50s now, glasses, silver streak in her hair. But there was a fire in her, the kind of fire you only get after surviving hell and walking out of it alive. We sat on a bench out front, just watching reporters flood the sidewalk with microphones and cameras, waiting for scraps of tragedy. I was 22 when he came, she said quietly. He wore gloves, had a knife. I thought I was going to die. I wanted to die, just to make it stop. I didn't interrupt. I just let her speak. Her voice shook at first, but then it steadied, got stronger, sharper. I rebuilt my life, got married, had kids, told myself it was over. But it wasn't, not really. Every creak of the floorboard, every phone call without a voice on the other end, it stayed. In my bones. You don't forget that kind of terror. You carry it. I asked her why she came to the courthouse today. She looked me dead in the eye and said, to look him in the face, and to remind him that he didn't fucking break me. That moment stuck with me. Still does. Because this wasn't just a story of a killer finally caught. It was a story of people who refused to be defined by what he did. A story of women who spoke up in a time when most were told to shut up and move on. A story of survivors who picked up shattered pieces and dared to keep living. And then there was the science. The tech that finally brought him down, genetic genealogy. I became obsessed. I interviewed the woman behind it, Barbara Rayventer. A retired attorney turned amateur genealogist who took crime scene DNA and built out a family tree from public genealogy databases. No one had ever done it before like this. It was revolutionary, controversial, but it worked. They matched crime scene DNA to distant relatives, then worked backwards, building family lines, narrowing it down, cross-referencing birthplaces, jobs, ages. And there he was, on paper, in blood, in chromosomes, Joseph James D'Angelo. The bastard had no idea his own family's DNA would betray him. The irony? Almost poetic. He spent decades making sure no one could trace him. No fingerprints. No evidence. Nothing. But in the end, it wasn't some fancy forensic breakthrough or undercover sting. It was family. It was science. It was a ghost that refused to stay buried. I stood outside that courthouse for hours after the press conference. Cars buzzed by. Reporters packed up. Survivors cried, embraced, or walked away in stunned silence. And I just stood there, thinking about every night I'd slept with a knife under my pillow. Every window I checked twice. Every name I wrote down as a boy, hoping I'd be the one to stop the nightmare. I wasn't the one to catch him, but I'd damn well be the one to tell his story, not from his perspective, but from ours, from the people who lived it, survived it, endured it, people who rebuilt from the ashes of silence and pain. He may have worn a mask all those years, but now the mask was off, and I was about to follow the trail of horror he left behind, step by brutal step. Chapter 3, The House He Built in Silence. I never thought I'd find myself driving through Citrus Heights again. Not after all these years. Not after I finally escaped the place that raised me and wrecked me in equal measure. But here I was, staring out through the windshield at streets that hadn't changed much since the 70s, even though everything else had. The houses were still modest. One-story ranch style with sun-bleached fences and patchy lawns. American flags on porches, wind chimes swaying in the breeze, garden gnomes watching from flower beds like silent sentinels. It looked so normal. So painfully, falsely normal. But somewhere on this street was his house. Joseph James D'Angelo. The fucking Golden State Killer. The house he lived in while women were raped just miles away. While couples were bound and beaten. While people hid knives beneath pillows and called the cops over every bump in the night. He came home to this street, slept, ate, mowed his lawn, and no one, not a neighbor, not a friend, not even his goddamn wife, ever knew. That's what I couldn't stop thinking about. How close he had been to being discovered. How he wore the mask of normalcy so well, so tightly, that it never once slipped. I found his address through court filings. Walked the block 3 times before I built up the nerve to stop. I parked 3 houses down. Didn't take any photos. Didn't want to be that guy. Just stood there, staring, soaking it in. The house was faded, pale beige, with an old satellite dish clinging to the roof like it had given up trying to stay connected to anything. A dead porch light, a dusty carport, a mailbox leaning just slightly to one side, like even it was exhausted from decades of secrets. What struck me most was how silent it all was. Not eerie, not haunted, just quiet, as if the house itself had learned to hold its breath, to never make a sound. Like its walls had trained themselves to forget the man who once lived inside. But the silence didn't fool me. I knew what had gone on behind those walls. The double life. The rituals. The planning. I had read every detail. He was a man of obsession. Detail-oriented. Methodical. He stalked his victims. He learned their routines. Broke into their homes days before the attack. Just to unlock windows, unload guns, or move objects around to assert quiet control. He was a master of psychological warfare, a living, breathing nightmare. And then he'd return, dressed in black, wearing a ski mask, gloves, sometimes with rope, sometimes with a gun, always with rage. And he didn't just hurt people, he violated them in every way a person can be violated. Body, mind, spirit. He made them feel small, helpless. He made sure of it. Then he'd go home, to this house. He'd shower. Toss his mask into a box in the garage. Watch TV. Kiss his daughters on the forehead. Eat leftovers. Sleep. Wake up. Pretend to be human. I felt my hands ball into fists at my sides. My pulse thudded in my ears. I couldn't scream. Couldn't punch anything. So I just stood there, letting the rage burn silently through me like acid in my throat. Because here's the thing nobody talks about enough. Monsters don't always look like monsters. Sometimes they coach Little League. Sometimes they clock in at the grocery store. Sometimes they walk your grandmother to the mailbox. And sometimes they wear a badge. Swear an oath. Serve and protect. And then go home and rape someone's wife while their children sleep in the next room. That was Joseph DeAngelo. A fucking coward wrapped in a cop's uniform. I went to the records department the next day. Buried myself in court transcripts, police reports, timelines. Dozens of yellowed files, coffee-stained pages, and scribbled notes from detectives who chased a phantom for decades. I followed every lead that had once gone cold. There were whispers, of course. Former colleagues who said he was off. That he was controlling. Short-tempered. Obsessed with rules. One guy said he once saw DeAngelo lose his shit over a stolen sandwich at work. Screamed at everyone for an hour. Another said he got caught peeping through a neighbor's window back in the day. But nothing ever came of it. He was one of us, they said. We didn't think. But no one ever does. That's what made him so dangerous. He knew how to blend in. Knew how to be invisible. Not just in the dark of night, but in plain goddamn daylight. I started making a list, victims by name, date, location, and MO. The rapes spanned Sacramento, Stockton, Modesto. Then came the murders, Ventura, Goleta, Irvine, Danville. The timeline was dizzying. One attack after another. Unrelenting. No breaks. No mercy. And then suddenly he stopped. Mid-1980s. Silence. Why? No one knows for sure. Some say he aged out. Lost the stamina. Others believe he came close to getting caught. That something scared him. Maybe one of the victims fought back. Maybe he got sloppy. Maybe the devil just ran out of gas. But the damage was already done. I found a box of victim statements in the archive room, sealed and marked sensitive. I wasn't supposed to see them, but I did. And what I read broke something in me. A man who had to lie on the floor while his wife was raped inches away. A woman who miscarried after her attack. A girl who never spoke again after she was tied up and told she'd be killed if she cried. These weren't just headlines or statistics. These were lives. Shattered. And the man who did it all had been living quietly in suburbia. Shopping at Save Mart. Mowing his lawn. Washing his car in the driveway like he didn't have blood on his hands. But here's the thing about silence. It doesn't erase the past. It just buries it under years of dust. and eventually, someone comes along to dig it up. Someone like me. I drove back to my motel room and locked the door behind me. I didn't turn on the light, just sat there in the dark, staring at the wall. I could feel it pressing in on me, that weight, that grief, that fury, that sick, hollow ache that settles into your ribs when the world stops making sense. I whispered his name once, Joseph, and then I whispered the other names, Kristen, Jane, Miguel, Deborah, Charlene, Brian, Katie, and on, the victims, the forgotten, the silenced. They had waited decades for justice, and now the mask was off. But justice wasn't enough. Truth had to follow. The whole goddamn truth. And I was going to drag it, screaming if I had to, out into the light. No more silence. No more shadows. Just me, a notebook, a microphone, and the ghost of a monster whose time had finally run out. Chapter 4. Echoes in the DNA. I had always believed monsters vanished when the sun came up. That was the lie we told ourselves in the 70s. That terror lived in shadows. That once morning came, we could breathe again, hang laundry in the yard, let our kids ride their bikes to school without the heavy knot of fear wrapped around our lungs. But I've come to learn that the monsters never left. They just learned how to blend in better during daylight. By 2018, Joseph DeAngelo had lived a long, uninterrupted life, while the lives he shattered remained frozen in time. Weddings missed. Children never born. Sleep that never came easy again. And all of it tied to one man. One name. One fucking monster. And what finally undid him? Saliva. Not rage. Not confession. Not guilt. Just a discarded tissue. He tossed it into a trash can outside his home in Citrus Heights, unaware, or maybe just arrogant, that his garbage would become his noose. Investigators had been watching him for months. Quietly. Carefully. They didn't confront him. Didn't rattle his cage. They watched. Waited. Followed him like he once followed others. And then, when he wiped his nose, balled up the tissue, and threw it away, they struck. That one crumpled piece of paper towel held the code to every nightmare. The DNA from that tissue matched the genetic fingerprint left behind at multiple crime scenes from decades prior. Samples pulled from semen, skin, sweat, blood. All those years, all those nights he thought he'd gotten away clean. And science reached across time and said, "You didn't." The method was revolutionary, genetic genealogy. A backdoor through which cold cases could finally breathe again. Here's how it worked. Public DNA databases like GEDmatch allowed users to upload their raw genetic data, often from consumer kits like 23andMe or AncestryDNA, in hopes of finding distant relatives, cousins, family connections, birth parents. It was a tool of curiosity, reunification, identity. But in the hands of forensic investigators, it became something else. A fucking time machine. They didn't need DeAngelo's DNA on file. All they needed was someone related to him. A cousin, a third cousin, a fourth cousin even. That was enough. Once they found a genetic match, they began the most painstaking process you could imagine, building out an entire family tree. Mapping branches backward, then forward, trimming away generations until all that was left was a man who fit the timeline, the geography, the psychological profile. A man who had once been a cop. A man who had been fired for stealing. A man who lived in California during the exact years of the attacks. A man who moved every time the killings moved. Joseph. Fucking. DeAngelo. I spent weeks with Paul Holes, the lead investigator who wouldn't let this case die. The man who stared at faded rape kits and crumbling crime scene photos for decades without ever letting go. He walked me through every step of the process. How they triangulated the DNA, ran it against census records, scoured social media, combed through marriage certificates and old driver's licenses. It was like building a haystack, Paul told me, and then reaching in and pulling out the only needle. He said the moment they zeroed in on DeAngelo, everything went quiet, like the wind left the room. We knew we had him, but it didn't feel like victory, he said. It felt heavy, like we were standing at the edge of a graveyard, because that's what it was, a graveyard of silence, of lives buried beneath decades of fear, of women who went unheard, of men who blamed themselves for not fighting harder, of children who grew up with parents who were never quite whole again. The day of the arrest was unceremonious. They pulled up to his driveway. He was outside, fiddling with something in his garage. No theatrics. No fight. Just a tired, old man looking confused, maybe even annoyed, as officers cuffed him and read him his rights. Neighbors stared from their porches, mouths open. It was like finding out the guy who always helped carry groceries was a goddamn serial killer. When the news broke, the world exploded. Victims called their families in shock. Reporters flooded every inch of California. Twitter melted. Survivors cried on camera. I watched it unfold like a slow-motion avalanche. The story didn't just belong to Sacramento anymore. It belonged to everyone. To every person who had ever lived with the ghosts of unanswered violence. I flew to Ventura County for the preliminary hearings. He was wheeled into the courtroom, shackled, wearing an orange jumpsuit, slouched in a wheelchair like a caricature of decay. Some thought it was an act. I wasn't so sure. I studied him the way he used to study us. His hands were twitchy. His eyes didn't focus. He muttered under his breath, but no one could hear what he said. And then he fell silent. For most of the hearing, he didn't speak, didn't look at the victims, didn't react. But I did. I watched their faces. Dozens of survivors and families packed shoulder to shoulder, bracing themselves against the weight of the room. Some stared at him with hatred. Others wept silently. And a few just looked numb. One woman, a survivor from Goleta, stood up and shouted, "You didn't win. You thought we'd forget, but we remember." The judge didn't stop her. No one did. It was a moment of beautiful, unfiltered defiance. Months passed. The legal process ground forward, slow and painful. The pandemic delayed everything. D'Angelo's legal team dragged their feet. But finally, in 2020, he agreed to a plea deal. 13 murders, dozens of rapes and burglaries, confessed in exchange for avoiding the death penalty. There was something grotesque about it. A man like that being allowed to live. To rot, sure, but to still breathe while his victims' families had buried their children, their spouses, their past selves? It didn't feel like justice. It felt like unfinished business. But then came the victim impact statements. 3 days, over 30 survivors. One after another, they took the stand, not to plead, not to beg, but to reclaim. They told their stories. Raw, unfiltered, guttural, voices cracking, hands trembling, faces stained with tears. They spoke of lost innocence, of sleepless nights, of marriages destroyed, of therapy and medication and years of wondering if the next knock at the door would be him. They looked him in the eye, and they told him who the fuck they had become despite him. One woman said, "You raped me when I was 13, but now I'm 55, and I'm still here." Another, "I used to hear your voice in every shadow, but now I hear mine, and it's louder." I sat in the back of that courtroom and cried, quietly, because they weren't just giving statements. They were taking back the goddamn narrative. And as I looked around at the faces of strangers who felt like family, I realized something. This story was never really about Joseph D'Angelo. It was about them, the ones who lived, the ones who carried grief like a second skin and kept going anyway. The ones who turned pain into purpose. He'll die behind bars, sure. Alone. Unmourned. But these people, they'll live. And for the first time in 40 years, the silence finally cracked. Chapter 5, The End of the Silence. The night before his sentencing, I sat in my car outside the Sacramento County Jail. It was nearly midnight. Summer heat still clung to the windows, and my shirt was damp with sweat and adrenaline. I could see the lit tower through the fog of my windshield. Concrete walls, razor wire, armed silence. Somewhere in that cage of steel and rot was the man who had stolen decades of peace, who had broken bodies and rewired minds, who'd made an entire state kneel in fear for years. And now he was alone in a cell, sleeping. Doubt it. Monsters don't rest easy when the hunt is over. I don't know why I drove there. I wasn't part of law enforcement. I wasn't even technically on assignment, but something in me had to see it. Had to know, physically know, that he was no longer free. That he could no longer slip through bedroom windows or press a blade to a terrified mother's neck while her children slept down the hall. I needed to feel the finality of it. That the long night was over. That for the first time in over 40 years, we won. I think a part of me wanted to scream at the walls. To force them to echo back everything he made us feel. But I didn't. I just sat there. Silent. Listening to my own breath. Listening for ghosts. They didn't come, because for once the air felt clean. The next morning, the courtroom was packed tighter than ever. Security had to turn people away. Families had flown in from across the country. Some had waited years for this. Others, decades. Some had buried their grief. Others wore it on their sleeves. but they were all here for the same reason, to watch Justice slam the door shut. D'Angelo was wheeled in like some pathetic sideshow relic. Thin, hollow, covered in a beige jumpsuit that looked one size too big, like even the uniform didn't want to cling to him. His eyes stared ahead, unfocused. His mouth hung slightly open, like his brain had already left the building. But we all knew the truth. He was listening, because when the final round of statements began, his body language shifted. He tensed, subtle at first, a twitch in the jaw, a tightening of the hands, a flicker of recognition when someone said his name, not Golden State Killer, not suspect, but Joseph James D'Angelo. His real name, his real face. No ski mask, no shadows, just a man, exposed, defanged, cornered by the truth. And truth, as it turns out, is louder than fear. Victim after victim stood and gave voice to pain that had lived in silence for far too long. One by one, they faced the man who once whispered threats in the dark and shouted him down in broad daylight. A father spoke of the night he was tied up while his wife was brutalized feet away from him. A daughter, born from a mother who never recovered, stood tall and said, "You didn't just take lives. You took peace. But not forever." An elderly woman, frail in frame but steel in her voice, said, "I used to picture killing you in my sleep. But now I don't need to. Because you are dead inside already." They didn't cry. They burned. And through it all, he said nothing. Not a single word. He just stared at the floor like it might open up and swallow him whole. I wanted to speak, too. I wasn't a victim. Not directly, but I lived in the wake of his terror. I inhaled the paranoia he left behind. I slept through the aftermath, the police radios, the cold sweats, the fear in my mother's eyes every time the house creaked. I carried his shadow for 40 years. And so I stood, not in rage, not for catharsis, but because someone had to speak for the kids who grew up in the darkness. For a long time, I said, "I thought you were a ghost. I imagined you as a demon, a specter. Something that couldn't possibly be human, because no human could do what you did and go home to kiss his daughters goodnight. No man could rape and murder and still smile at his neighbors the next morning." I looked at him. He didn't look back. "But now I see you. Not a monster. Not a ghost. Just a coward in flesh. A man who hid in closets and jumped out at the weak. You weren't powerful. You were pathetic. And now you're nothing. Just another old man waiting to die in a concrete box." Silence. And then I sat. The judge took his time, reviewed each case, every charge, every name, every life. And then, with the weight of the state of California behind his voice, he delivered the final sentence. Life in prison. 11 consecutive life terms. Without the possibility of parole. And that was it. No final words from D'Angelo. No apologies. No parting shot. Just chains rattling as he was wheeled away. He would die behind those walls. Forgotten. Uncelebrated. Alone. It's been months now. I've gone back to writing full-time. No more chasing ghosts. No more combing through yellowed files in dusty archive rooms. But the story never really left me. I still wake up some nights expecting to hear that click. The soft latch of a window sliding open in the dark. Old habits die hard. But now there's something else. Peace. It doesn't come all at once. It's not loud. It's not dramatic. It arrives in moments. The sound of laughter in a home that used to be filled with silence. The way a woman walks freely through her neighborhood again, unafraid of the night. The way survivors raise their voices now, not as victims but as witnesses, as warriors. I think about Kristen a lot, the survivor I met outside the courthouse. She's traveling now. Last I heard, she was writing a book, teaching workshops on reclaiming your story. I think about Paul Holes, who refused to quit. I think about the DNA genealogists who mapped fate in chromosomes. I think about every woman who said, "I will not be defined by what he did." And I think about the little boy I used to be. The one who heard that click in the night. The one who thought the monster was in the closet. Turns out, the monster was next door. But monsters lose their power when you name them. When you drag them into the light. When you speak. So that's what I'll keep doing. Speaking. Telling the story. Not just of Joseph James D'Angelo, but of everyone who lived through him. Everyone who fought like hell to reclaim their peace. The Golden State Killer is unmasked. And the silence. It's over. Forever.